Hey there, this is Seth Juarez again from Channel 9 here with Tomasz Petrycek. I thought we would take a look at some code. In a previous video, we talked a little bit about why F-sharp was really a good idea to use, what were some scenarios that made it really interesting. But I thought maybe we'd take a look a little bit more about code. The one thing that we talked about that was most interesting, to me at least, was the way that you model things in F-sharp. So tell us a little bit about that, and maybe you can show us some code.
Yeah. So, we decided we'll show you how to do some domain modeling, and we picked just a basic sample with products. Mm-hmm. And use that a little bit as an example. Okay. One other thing that I actually wanted to show here is how you start with F-sharp.
Okay.
So I have a Visual Studio here, all in nice full screen mode, and I do have F-sharp Interactive open.
Now, does this come by default with Visual Studio, or is there something you have to download?
Yeah, if you have a Visual Studio installed and you go to File, New, Project, then obviously on my machine it says F-sharp and other languages.
Right.
On everyone else's machine, I guess you'll see F-sharp under the other languages.
Right.
There's one thing you might want to install though, which is Visual F-sharp Power Tools.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an extension that adds more stuff on top of the basic F-sharp support in Visual Studio.
Okay.
It adds things like refactoring and nicer colorization.
Fantastic.
So you definitely want to download that.
Okay. So let's talk about the process of working on an F-sharp thing.
Yeah.
How do you go about it?
Yeah. So I usually start just by creating a script file.
So what's the difference between a script file and something else? What are the other things?
So you can create a project and you get the fsproj file with multiple files in it.
Right.
You can add references and everything.
Okay.
And script file is just a more lightweight thing. So you have one file, I'll create one here, F-sharp script file, and the only thing it creates a script file, mm-hmm. where you can type things and then you can save it somewhere. But
Got
it's
it.
Just a standalone file for exploring things and interactive programming.
Fantastic. Well, let's define a model.
Yeah, so we said we are going to start with a product.
Okay.
And I'll start really, really simple.
Okay.
And let's just say that the product is a tuple, with string, the name of the product, and decimal, the price.
So this is an interesting construct that I see right here. It's saying string times a decimal, but you're not multiplying it. What does this actually represent?
Well, under the cover, it's compiled just as a tuple in .NET. It does actually represent multiplication if you're a mathematician.
Oh, so tell us about that.
Well, that's probably for a separate video.
Right.
But the idea is, if you can think of string or decimal as a set.
Okay.
With all the possible values.
So it's like a cross product of all the values of string and decimal.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I like that. So the type of product is a string and a decimal. The thing I like about this is it's so minimal.
Yeah. That's the nice thing.
Right.
When you're writing the domain model, you just need one line.
Okay. So let's move on. What else can we do here?
So I guess the other thing we'll need here is we will write something that searches for products.
Okay.
And then we'll need some search result. So I'll start just by saying a search result is, and then here we are going to use the other F-sharp type, which is discriminated union. And we can say search either succeeded and returned a valid product, or it failed and say ID was invalid.
And this is what we were talking about before when we're actually modeling things. We're actually describing the entire universe of what a search result is going to be.
Yeah.
So instead of having a search result be a product or null, which represents nothing of everything, here this is returning a valid search result or an invalid search result.
Yeah, I guess the main thing is here that if we have a value of type product, it cannot be null.
Right.
So in languages where you have null, it's basically like you're adding this invalid option to everything in your world.
I see, that's cool. So what does this look like when you use it in a function?
Yeah, so let's see, what could we do?
We're gonna have a function to search for a product.
Yeah. So we say search product by ID. We'll take some ID, and then I don't have any database ready, so let's just write something by hand. I can match the ID with something, and if it's 42, then
of course
we are going to return a valid product. So here, what's going to be in the product?
I see.
Name.
So that's weird. It's like making valid a function almost, it seems like.
Yeah, it's more like a constructor.
Okay.
So you're basically saying create a new search result with the valid case representing the product. So this is the answer. That's my product.
Of course.
And what's the price? I guess that's quite a lot. So let's do 100. And that's it. Now you can actually start seeing interesting things here because we can look at the type of the function. So that's the type inference coming in.
Mm-hmm.
If I do look at this, then it says search product by ID is a function that takes an int and returns search result.
Got it.
And I didn't have to say anything.
Yeah, I was going to say that because right here you see that there is no type annotation for what ID is.
Yeah.
But because you said 42 is what it's being matched with, it's going to automatically know this is an ID.
That's exactly how it works. Okay. And then it says, because this valid thing is a constructor of search result, the result has to be a search result. If I did something wrong here, like try to return something that's not a product, then it would say, doesn't work, expected product, but got three things.
I see. So right now, because we're having type inference happening on the actual parameters of the function and the return type. And what's happening is there could be a valid of something else, of some other type that has a three tuple, and that would be okay. But since none of that ever existed.
Yeah. Well, in this case, we are saying valid is only of products.
Okay.
So we could actually do a little bit of refactoring here and just use the built-in F-sharp option type.
Okay.
So we could say search result is actually an option of product. And then we can say when the option type has two cases, just like our valid invalid, but they're called sum and none. So we can say just return sum, and that's our option of product here.
I see. And that the interesting thing here is, like you showed us that discriminated union, but that's such a common use case for discriminated union that it's just an option.
Yeah, exactly.
Now it feels like though it's incomplete.
Ah, well, it not only feels like that, but F-sharp actually tells you it's incomplete.
That's cool.
So it actually when you're that's the nice thing about this pattern matching using match. Mm-hmm. Because the F-sharp compiler is checking what are the kind of possible values you may get.
Right.
And it makes sure that you're handling all the cases.
Cool.
So this is really useful for sort of when you're building a domain model and you're pattern matching, it makes sure that you're doing the right thing.
Okay.
So here it tells us, for example, zero is not covered. Well, we actually just want to say, whenever there's something else, return null. So the other thing we can do here is actually test the code. So I'm going to select the two lines and do Alt Enter.
Okay, and when you do Alt Enter, it's actually executing over on the interactive window.
That's right, okay. Yeah. So if you don't see F-sharp interactive, I think it's under View, F-sharp interactive.
There it is, Control-Alt-F.
Control-Alt-F, and then you can select any piece of F-sharp code and run it there or define it there. So here we're just really defining the types so that they're on the right-hand side and the function. And then we can also call it and say, let's find the first product. And you can see the answer there because this one is none.
Right.
Or we can do 42 and then we get the answer there.
Sum of the answer. Got it.
So I guess the other fun thing here is I talked about null before,
right?
So we can actually see what happens here. If we do search product by ID, I could say if P is not null, then print OK. And it doesn't even let me do the null check. And it says this doesn't work because the option type doesn't have null as a value.
And so even because this construction works in C#, and you can check if anything's null.
Yeah.
And in F sharp, it's saying, well, it can't be null search result because it's either sum of a product or none.
Yeah. Okay. And there's a nice analysis on one blog. We can share the link where someone is looking at how many lines of code in a regular C sharp code base they wrote. It's actually just null checks. It turns out to be quite a lot.
Yeah.
So I guess what we can do in F sharp is just delete it.
Just ignore it. Got it. So let's beef it up a little bit, because it feels like, because P is of type product, but when you do P dot, you just have, is it something? Is it nothing? What's the value?
So I guess we, like here, P is actually not of type product.
It's an option of product.
It's an option of product. But what we were doing here is kind of naughty, because we just said product is a tuple with string and decimal. And in any sort of real code, you want to name them. You want to say the string actually means the name.
Because then you could have a tuple of int, decimal, int, string, string, decimal, and that doesn't
make
any sense.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So tuples are really nice for sort of dirty, quick prototyping. But then you can evolve it. And so what we can do is, what we can do here is just use a record.
Okay. So what's the difference between a record and a class? Because I know that F sharp is a functional first language, but you can define classes in F sharp. So what's the difference between a record and a class? Is it the same distinction as a record and a class inside of C sharp? Well, I guess it'd be a struct.
I guess record in F sharp is kind of close to anonymous types in C sharp, except you have to name it. I guess the main difference is, by default, when you're defining it, it just has data and no functionality. There's actually one nice thing we can show here as well, which is that records in F sharp by default support structural equality. So this is really nice for testing.
Interesting. What is structural equality?
I guess it's easier to show that.
Okay, let's do it.
So let's just...
So you just went ahead and gave product the string decimal, but now they have names.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
So product has a name of type string and the price of type decimal. Search result is still option of product. And we have to change it here to return a product with this name and this price.
Okay.
And to create it, you just use curly brackets.
And now P down here should be still an option of product, but but P should give you
product
something
option
when you do P dot value.
So if we want to do something with product, well, let's show the structural equality first.
Okay.
So I guess the typical way I use the F sharp interactive is that I write some code and then I just write some little snippets of code to test it.
Okay.
And I can then take it later and extract it into a unit test. So one test I could do here is to say, well, I'm assuming that this should actually equal, because I'm doing 42, I should get back something that's sum, answer with name, the answer, and the price should be equal to this. And in F sharp, single equals isn't mutation, but it's just equality testing.
Okay.
So if I run this piece of code and then run this piece of code, it says true.
Oh, see, because in a normal language, well, normal, you know, in a different kind of language, you'd have to say, if p.name equals string and p.price equals 100, then return true.
Yeah.
But this is actually going through and looking at the structure and saying, okay, if for true equality, all members need to be the same.
Yeah, because the product is immutable. So it doesn't really make sense to talk much about references.
I see.
It's just the product has this name, has this price. If you have a product with the same name and the same price, well,
it's
they're the
same
thing.
That's pretty cool.
So this is amazingly useful for writing unit tests, because you just have a function, you call it, and you compare the results.
Okay. So let's get into something a little bit more complicated. You had an example you were showing me earlier with Markdown. Let's take a look at that. Or is there anything else here that we can show briefly that would help us understand what the benefits of F sharp are?
Well, I guess the last example we can do here is just to say, like what we were saying before, because the P here is an option. In C sharp, when you were writing this sort of function, you would probably return null or product.
Right.
And we showed that here you can't even do the null check, but F# doesn't really give you an access to the name and price because this is an option. So again, what we have to do here is to say match P with, and then if it's some product, then we can print got, and let's print the name of the product. And now here we can actually get the name.
Got it.
And if we forget the other case, it again tells us, well, you're not handling null.
Yeah.
So let's do that.
None. And oops.
And we got the answer.
Right. That's cool. So just in this little example, I'm feeling like F# is really built for conciseness.
Yeah, and the fact that you can define the domain model on one page, or here really just two lines, means that you can show it to your colleagues and talk about it, and you just better understand what your code does.
And it's pretty concise. I mean, you're saying that there's a thing called a product, it has a name and a price. Like, they don't, like, if they don't even know what a string and a decimal is, it's okay. You say, this is just a number, and this is just some kind of text.
Yeah, I was sort of cheating here a little bit, because in reality, I would probably put it on multiple lines.
Got it.
And it's still pretty concise, because when you're writing XML comments, you don't, if you just want to put in summary, you don't have to say summary. So here we could have some really useful comment like represents a product.
Okay.
You probably don't want to put that in, but put something more useful. Price in US dollars.
That's
so
cool.
It gets a bit longer when you add the comments, but it's still pretty
short.
But
the thing is, like, now you're giving people the actual code instead of a Word doc with the definition of the code.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool.
It doesn't get out of sync.
Okay, so let's look at that. There was a longer example that you were showing me earlier that I thought would be cool to look at.
Yeah. Should we start from scratch, or should we show the existing one?
I think let's show the existing one, and then that way, because I usually debug stuff really badly. You probably don't.
All right, so I do have an example here. No, that's not the one. This is the right one.
Okay.
What this does, it starts with a little script.
And which, you're highlighting, doing Alt Enter to run it.
Exactly. So I do this, and because I'm a old .NET developer, I only know how to use WinForms.
Guilty.
Yeah,
me too.
Yeah. So this creates a window here, which I'm going to use later on for showing some HTML.
Okay.
And then this is more interesting domain model.
Okay.
So what I'm saying here is, and this is modeling documents.
Okay.
So the problem I'm solving here is you want to have some code that produces documents. And we want to have a little embedded domain-specific language for building the documents.
Got it.
And really, the core here is to define the domain model. So what is a document?
Okay.
And here we're saying a document or a markdown node can be a literal containing a string, or it can be some strong text.
Right, like the bold usually is what.
Yeah. And then that one is actually interesting because here
it's referring to itself.
Yeah. And you can have things like strong inside emphasis or.
This feels like BNF-esque type stuff.
Yeah.
Bacchus-Narr form is the way you define languages back. I don't know if you still do. But it feels very BNF-esque when you're defining a type.
Yeah, okay. It's compilable and not a Word document.
Right.
So yeah, you're basically defining what kind of, how you can construct nodes. And so we have that. We have paragraph, which again can contain other node. We have heading, which has two things. So here we are using tuple again.
It's like an H1 through an H6, for example.
Yeah. So now actually you said something interesting, because if you look at this, this is wrong.
Yeah, because actually a heading can be a heading of a list, of a sequence, of a paragraph, of a strong, or a literal, right? Because it's markdown node.
Yeah.
But it's a number of any of those things.
Well, so the int here means the size. So I guess this would be like one and then some literal.
Right.
means H1 with some text in there. But because we have int here, that's kind of wrong because we could create H175.
That's right.
I have a simplified example that's not fully correct here. But you can already see, if you just go through the few lines of code, what kind of potential issues are there.
It's literally 7 lines of code.
Yeah.
And we can already see that maybe a heading should be a heading of a special kind of int that takes 1 through 6.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And instead of a markdown node, it could be a literal.
Well, you can still have strong inside heading.
That's true.
But you can't have paragraph inside heading.
Oh, you can't. You have a sequence. You can put anything inside of a heading because it's containerable, but it might not render properly.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, so I guess in the and this is just a simplified example, but it's based on an open source project that I'm maintaining.
Got it.
And there we have 2 things. You have inline stuff like strong, link, and you have blocks. Like headings.
And I think that it speaks to the larger issue of, because we just started talking about how this might not be right, but we could do that with just 7 lines of code and already start to reason about a larger problem or a larger program that we're building.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was pretty neat.
It's simplified example, but it's not entirely unrealistic.
Yeah.
If you actually look at the open source project, which I have for working with Markdown, that's maybe like 20 lines of code.
I see.
So it's twice as complex as this one, but still pretty short.
Cool. All right.
So we have the definition here. Then the list, that's like UL with LI elements. So we have a list of things in the list. And the last interesting one is a sequence where we say, well, just render all of these things in one block.
Got it.
And then we want to be able to format the documents. So format node is a function that takes a node and produces a string. I'm using slightly tricky shortcut here, function, but it really just means take a node and then pattern match on the node.
I see. So what is that function? It seems like it's a key word. Is it just doing this?
Yeah, yeah. It's just a key word which does exactly this.
But I think that if you were to control Z back to what you had, it knows, it automatically is able to infer that it's a function that takes a node.
Yeah.
Because the format node is the name of the function.
Format node is just a name, could be anything.
But it doesn't, because there's a parameter here that's sort of elided. But it knows what it is because of this pattern matching sequence.
Exactly. And again, if we forget one of the cases here, then it will tell us, look, you're not handling all the cases, you're missing literal. Go back and fix your code.
But how does it know? Is it because that's the only thing that exists? That's the only type that exists right now?
It looks at the, so here, these bits here are patterns. And strong and paragraph are constructors of the node. So it knows, well, I have a strong here, and that's a node. So I have to be taking a node as an input. And yeah, there's all these cases in Markdown node, and there's all the cases here. It's actually fairly clever.
Yeah.
I could say just one, and then it goes back and tells me, oh, look. What if this is heading 0?
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Right, so now we've got this one, and I got an error in my F-sharp interactive. And that's actually because when I talked about the Markdown node, I forgot to evaluate that in the F-sharp interactive.
Okay, so we,
so we have to go back and do Alt-Enter on this one, and now it will know what literal, strong, and so on are.
So let's pause a second. This one, instead of let, is a let rec.
Yeah.
Tell us about this, because this is defining a recursive function.
Yeah. Like. Well, if we delete the rec, then it just tells us inside here, we can't call format node. In F-sharp, when you want to write a recursive function, you have to be explicit and just mark it as recursive. And here, we really need recursive function because, for example, paragraph contains another node. So we want to format that node as well.
And sort of the base case is here for literal. It feels like it's a recursive sort of descending thing that's going on.
Yeah, we're just walking over a tree, and here we have the leaf of the tree, and the other one's call format node as well.
Got it. Before we move on, working with lists is a little bit different in F#. And I see down here when you're working with the sequence mm-hmm. of nodes that you're doing something there. What is that sort of pipe greater than thing doing?
So what I'm doing here is I get items, which mm-hmm. is a list. Mm-hmm. And there's various ways to do this in F#. But what I'm doing here is that in the square brackets, it's creating like list computation mm-hmm. in which I can say, well, for all the elements, produce a string.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to return a list of those things.
That's right, yeah. This is string list,
okay,
or list of strings. It's kind of the same like the enumerator or iterator in C#,
mm-hmm.
But sort of inline and very concise.
Got it.
The other thing I could do here, and I could just say list.map, and use the piping operator. So what I'm saying here is take items and pass this as an input to list.map, and for every item, what we want to do is the same thing that we had before. So for every item, produce, format the node, and wrap it with li, and again we get back string list.
And this piping that happens, I see also in the sequence mm-hmm. of nodes that's happening down there. The piping, what it's doing is it's saying, I have nodes, push the nodes into the map function.
That's right, yeah.
But when you're mapping them, map them and execute format node for each one.
Yeah.
And then once you have that whole list of things, let's push that list of things, because it's going to return a format node. It's going to return a string for a list of strings, and then you're sort of pushing them together and concatenating them with nothing.
Yeah. So concat takes the separator as the first argument, and the second argument is sequence of strings, and it produces one string. So what we are doing here is we explicitly specify the empty string mm-hmm. as the separator, and then pipe will give us the input for the second parameter.
So this is a way of pushing, because list map takes a function and a set, right?
A list, yeah.
Yeah, a list, sorry, set's different, right? And so if you were to highlight over list.map, does it show you what it requires? Yeah, so it requires a list. So explain what this is saying, because this is a little confusing.
Yeah, so this is saying you need to have input, which is list of t's,
mm-hmm.
And the list.map function is generic, so it figures out, well, it can work on anything.
Right.
So we have a list of t's as an input, mm-hmm. and then the first bit here is saying we need a function from t to u. So
which is going to be the format node.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's taking a markdown node, which is t, to u, which is the string.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay, so it looks like there's some things being hidden here, because you typed out those functions, but you typed them out in curried form, right? And that's because in F# you can evaluate a function with only like one parameter, even though it requires five, and it will return a function that requires four. And it feels like here you're already evaluating string concat, and it's returning a new function that's taken. So explain that a little bit again.
Yeah. So, well, I guess first of all, if we didn't write this with pipes,
mm-hmm.
then what we would get, and I'm going to do some copy pasting here.
Sure.
So we would just actually say concat something where that thing looks like this. So this means the same thing, except I did a typo.
Right.
So this is just calling list.map with two arguments, format node and the nodes.
Got it.
But in F#, this you can read it in two different ways. You can read it as calling map with two separate arguments,
uh-huh.
or you can read it as calling map with format node, and I can actually parenthesize it. So we can say call map with format node, and then we get back a function that takes the nodes. So that's exactly what the pipe operator is doing.
It's pushing data forward, but it's doing it in a really, because I mean, implicit typing is happening, but F#, make no mistake, is a very strongly typed language.
Yeah, yeah. You have types for everything everywhere. So what the pipe operator does is that it just reverses the order here. So if I do this, it means the same thing as what I had there before.
I see.
I guess then it's kind of similar to what you do in C# when you're just using extension methods.
Got it.
The nice thing is that in F#, this style of programming really works for everything. So.
Got it. And if you were to omit the string, it would not work, right? Because it would no longer be a sequence of nodes. It would be turning a function that still needs a string somehow.
Yeah, yeah. You get an error saying, well, I was expecting, so here I was expecting to get something that takes a string list and produces
a string.
But what you give me here is the string concat function
that takes a something.
Which takes a string.
And returns a string, yeah.
And returns a string. Yeah. So your types are wrong. The other nice thing about the pipe operator, and I guess that's showing the conciseness of F#, is that it's not a built-in thing. Uh-huh. It's actually just defined in the library. So you can define your own operator, like the pipe, and say, well, I'm going to take some input and the function, and I'm going to call this function with the input. And that's the definition. Or if you want to be super concise, you just do xf, fx, and then I think it fits on something like 15 characters. You could delete some more spaces if you want to produce unreadable code. But yeah, it's just one of the things that you get from the flexibility of the language.
And now it feels like we're getting all the way down to lambda calculus almost. When we were
There's probably one hidden down there.
That's right. Cool. All right, so let's see the sample document. Maybe you can explain what this sample document is, and then we can see the whole thing run.
Yeah. So the sample doc, and this is just a sort of inline example that you could write, for example, for tests, where we are saying, well, just construct a document.
And the document is what was the name of the type? A markdown node. And a markdown node can be a number of things, and we're just going to make this a sequence of something.
Yeah. Okay. We're just saying a document is a sequence, and this takes a list of nodes. So when we create the sequence, we have to give it a list of things, and we give it one heading, H1 with some literal in there, paragraph with some literal, and a list containing two elements,
right.
Li elements with strong at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So if I select this bit of code and run it, then again, it evaluates it in F# Interactive.
And now you're saying, okay, doc, so you could say show HTML parentheses format node parentheses doc, but instead we're reversing it and saying let's push the doc through these things.
Yeah, it's just writing the transformation style again, composing, and you can sort of see it here, because format node says from markdown node go to string, show HTML says from string go to nothing. And document is markdown node.
Right.
So this is the only way to compose things. And if we run it, then we'll see it here in the window.
That's awesome. This has been pretty neat, I think, hopefully a little enlightening for those that are watching, just to see how you go about thinking about things in F#.
Yeah, yeah. And the next step would be to split it. Like here, I actually got pretty far with just a script file. But you can then take it, turn it into a project, create one file for your domain model at the beginning, then create file with transformations, and then use it from a unit test project or from a script file.
So this would be the beginning of what you're doing, and then you just take this code, move it into a project.
Yeah.
Now, is ordering important in F# projects?
Yeah.
And tell us why.
Well, that's sort of an important thing here. So when you create the project, you can only access things that are in earlier files.
Have been defined already.
Yeah. And it sort of forces you to have a nice structure, right, because you have to start with the domain model that's used in everything else. There's actually another interesting blog post that we can share with the audience, uh-huh, that analyzes circular dependencies. Uh-huh. And in F-sharp, you don't really have any.
Right, because you're starting generically and then getting down specific. So until you execute one function that sort of just starts to call everything.
Yeah, yeah. So it makes your structure a lot more sort of understandable. And it, in general, just makes your project simpler.
Cool.
It's something that you have to get used to because it feels a bit weird at the beginning. Uh-huh. But I was working on a project called Deedle, which is data science sort of time series, uh-huh, and frame library. And I had one case, and that's like fairly large project. And I had one case where I felt like, how can I do this without the circular dependency? Uh-huh. And then after some head scratching, I figured it out. And I realized that's actually much nicer. And it basically made me design the project properly.
That's cool. So in essence, it's going to force you down this path of correctness, one hopes.
Yep, yep.
Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us and looking at some actual code. Where can someone go to sort of find a little bit more about these things? Where can one start with F-sharp?
Well, I guess the best place to start is just go to the fsharp.org website.
Okay.
So this is now an independent, non-profit foundation for F-sharp. Mm-hmm. If you go here, there's learn. Just follow the links from there.
Cool.
Fsharp.org is the best start. And you can see we even got the pipe in the logo here.
Nice. That's cool. Thanks. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us. Thanks so much for watching. And we will catch you next time. Take care.